This is Harv Aronson of the Total Sports Recall Podcast, and when I start my workday, it always begins with that morning shower. Normally, I use a liquid body wash, but recently I purchased a bar of Sterling Soap Company's handcrafted bath soap and decided to give their Deep Blue Sea handcrafted bath soap a try. Immediately, the aroma of Sterling's bath soap was obvious, and in using this soap, I felt refreshed, clean, energized, and Sterling's bath soap helped me step out of that shower with the momentum and eagerness to get my day rolling. If you want to get a refreshing wake-up call in the morning and get your busy day off to the right start, I highly recommend going to Sterling Soap Company's website and order one of their many varieties of bath soaps among other products they offer. Visit Sterling Soap Company at sterlingsoap.com. That's STIRLINGsoap.com.
Pressed by Torres, the set, the kick, and the fish. It's deep to left field. This one may be off the wall, maybe in the screen.
Lang and Chernyshev on top as expected. They're eligible for Salt Lake City.
Indian All-Star.
All right, Bill Black here with the Indian All-Stars podcast. I have the privilege and honor to be speaking with Ms. Temrys Lane, Lummi Nation, soccer player extraordinaire, and media personality. Temrys, welcome. Can you flesh out my brief and humble introduction?
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. Got your email and was like, yes, this is an incredible opportunity to come share a story with you. So I really appreciate being here. And Nansiyam Anachalachasiyam Chelitia Temrys Lane Senesnet Chuck Lummison. Chuck Lummison, I come from the Golden Eagle clan of Lummi Nation. I'm the daughter of Galen Lane and Lydia Bennett, and the granddaughter of the late Swayloos and Sneetna, Vernon and Nancy Lane from Lummi Nation. And on my mother's side, who's English, Irish, Scottish, Ukrainian, the granddaughter of the late Lee, Ernest Lee Bennett, and my grandma, Christine Gerhold. So I'm honored to be here and just share a little bit of story with you, Bill. Thanks for having me.
Excellent. Thank you. And thank you for the traditional introduction. That's fabulous. I need to be more cognizant of that myself, I think. So thanks for
it. The fast moving pace of life can get in the way of that. But when I get the opportunity and remember, I know that they're smiling down on me.
Yes, absolutely. So, well done.
Thank you.
So, let's jump right in. How does a girl from sleepy Bellingham, although it's a little more bustling now than it was back in the day.
It's true.
How does kid from Bellingham end up traveling the world, playing soccer on the international stage? Tell us that story.
Oh, thank you. Wow, my life story, more or less, which has changed in this chapter of my life. I'm a mama now. I have two boys, 1 and 3. And I'm the vice president of Indian Country Practice at Pyramid Communications. And really, it was all because of soccer. So I guess I'll start from the beginning, which is I was born with an older brother, Dakota Lane, now Dr. Dakota Lane, who's the doctor out at Lummi Res.
Excellent.
Yep. And man, he didn't take it easy on me. And I give him so much credit for, you know, pushing me. And the competitiveness started out of the womb. And I just wanted to do everything he did and you know, do it better. So up there and like all around the Northwest and growing across the United States, soccer was the thing. It continues to be the thing, and it the game just continues to evolve and grow. But I kind of outgrew the competitiveness up there, in to the fact that by the time I was 14, I was playing on the U19 teams for the FC Rangers in Bellingham. You know, in the we were at the time 4A at Seahome when I was in high school, and was playing on varsity as many people do when they end up being elite players. But ended up earning earning the Adidas State Player of the Year for Washington, which was wild. But part of that was because I had my mom had really recognized not just my skill and talent, but mostly my love and dedication. And I was also, my first activity was ballet. I loved ballet. I was really committed to doing that. And at the age of 12, I remember my mom picking me up from ballet and probably was driving me to soccer practice or like the next day. And she said, you know, we can't keep this up. And both of your coach and your ballet instructor want you to spend more time with your perspective.
Right. You know, so you got to pick something.
So you have to pick. And it was like without question that I was picking soccer. I do love dance, and I've returned to it in different ways, not ballet, but I picked soccer. And from that moment, I really committed, and it became my number one priority, along with education. Mm-hmm. For me, they're not separate. And
thank you for that.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, it was instilled within me from my grandma, my parents, my father, everybody. You have to get in. It was used as leverage, actually. My mom would say, you got to get your homework done, got to get good grades, and I will commit to driving you down to Seattle to play with, on the first, it was this program called Olympic Development Program, where you would try out with other players in your state, get selected on the district, and then the state team, and then the regional team, and then eventually the national team. Okay. In my youth, I never made the national team, but I did when I was 20. When I was 20, I made the U23 national team. And that was after my first year in college at Arizona State. So the summary of my youth career was I played on a really competitive state championship team, Emerald City FC, Azuri FC. We won the state championship in 2000. And it really, we played in all these, we won a ton of tournaments all over the nation. And it really propelled me and created visibility for D1 coaches. Just acknowledging that my mother also had the time. I mean, she made the time to afford to be able to drive me down to Seattle 3 to 4 times a week, which is 96 miles away. So,
So can I ask maybe a little bit of a personal question, but
sure.
coming from the communities that we come from, that not only is a big time commitment, but there's a lot of financial obligation that goes along with that too. How did your parents manage that? Was that a challenge? Was that a struggle? Was that something that was Yeah.
It was certainly my parents separated when I was seven. My father's a fisherman and my mother is in real estate and commercial real estate.
Okay.
And I think not just the money, but the affordability of that leisure time, right? For my mom to be able to say, I'm leaving work at 3 o'clock or 4 o'clock. She had that ability.
Yes.
And that I think is something that people don't think about, is like, where's the time to be able to invest in your children sometimes. So, and you know, my mom is a non-native and understood how to navigate certain systems. She's a white woman with, and has always advocated for me and my siblings in ways that, I think having that access to privilege also, I just want to name it, as part of my success.
Sure.
Our team had a lot of wealthy folks on it, Emerald City FC. And we would do certain fundraisers, or I will say that I would save my own money. I would earn money from different jobs. I worked at the fireworks stand, my grandparents' fireworks stand. Yeah. That was my first job. I babysat, I washed cars. I did modeling as a child. Also that paid, my brother and I did, which paid really well for a kid, and my mom would put that in a bank account. So I worked, and a lot of that money would go into the fees for said tournament, or my mom would say, okay, I will pay half, you have to pay the other half. Or my dad would buy my gear, you know, so it was a struggle and it was a hustle. And I will just say it, it was like also just understanding how to navigate a lot of that as well, from sure. through my mom's lens, I think was really, really part of the access to privilege.
Yeah. The reason I ask that is a lot of times that is a perceived barrier, but if you really want to do it, you find a way, right?
And I think if you show the folks around you and the community around you how passionate you are, you'd be surprised who'd be willing to help. A lot of that also meant that my mom couldn't drive me all the time, so we would drive south to the closest people in Mukilteo, and they would, you know, support our family in like getting me to and from, or like on weekend tournaments, I would stay with other families. And it was a shuffle, and it was a lot of coordination, and it was a lot of energy, but it was an investment into my future for sure. Yeah. And it ultimately, you know, when I was a sophomore year, I was getting letters from colleges, top D1 universities all over. And that wasn't it. I didn't sit back. Yeah. I didn't sit back and say, great, people want, I wrote back to all of the coaches. I wrote letters back. I wrote emails back. I made phone calls. And that was also part of my mom's teaching, is like, you better show them that you're interested, and you better thank them for taking the time to reach out to you. I was a very active participant in my recruiting process. And then, you know, when the time came, when I didn't anticipate that I would be going to Arizona State, but I went on a recruiting visit there with another friend of mine who I played with at a top level from Washington. She's from Tacoma. And they put the pressure on and offered a full ride to both of us kind of at the same time, thinking like, if I can get one, I can get the other. And yeah. She was right. We both ended up committing. That, you know, that was the journey into collegiate D1 soccer, became a Sun Devil. I really wanted to go to UCLA. I thought I was going to go to UCLA. I was being recruited by UCLA, but then the coach left, that was recruiting me. And so then the new coach brings in their own prospects, right?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that was a little bit of a bummer, but I ended up making it back to UCLA for my graduate degree in American Indian Studies, my IA.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So during that whole process, and we can just say it. You're pretty darn good. At what point did you realize or think or say, you know what? I can play with these other girls. I can do this. When did that hit you? Was it a gradual thing, or was it like when you woke up one morning and said, by God, I'm doing this?
Well, I just had a visceral reaction because I went back to the moment that changed my life. I was 14. I mentioned the ODP, Olympic Development Program. Mm-hmm. I had made it the first year onto the district team. And then I think it was the first year I was 14. I might have started when I was 13 and then made districts a year young. But then when I was 14, I not only made the district team, but then I made the state pool. And you become really close with these players that are from everywhere across Washington. And I had played with them in different friendlies or scrimmages. They became my friends and my teammates. And then it came down to the coach scaling from, I think, maybe 26 players or maybe even 30 players down to 20 or 18, down to 18. And
that's
I made 22. So I did not make the traveling 18. I became an alternate so that if somebody else, so I essentially got cut.
Right.
If somebody else got injured or didn't make it to the big regional, and everybody was headed to the regional camp, which is where you spend over a week with other states in the West Coast region, training with college coaches that are signed up for this, and then playing on, you know, your state team and playing in these big matches that end up being college showcases. Uh-huh. And I was devastated. I was absolutely devastated. And it was this failure, it hurt so bad. And it was such a telling moment for me that showed me how badly I really wanted this. I sucked it up and I went on the United team because as an alternate, you had the option to like go to this regional camp as a member of like the Idahos or the Alaskas to kind of fill in the rest of their roster.
They don't have enough, right?
And so I did that and I was miserable.
Really?
I was so sad. Well, I was just, I was so sad not to be with my team. I was so sad not to be with my team, my friends, representing Washington. Washington was always one of the strongest states next to the Californias. There's a Northern California, Southern California. But I did it. It was a really important experience in my life because I, you know, you had to set down my pride or my hurt, and I went and I did it. But I was determined to make the team the next year, or I gave myself an ultimatum. If I don't make the team the next year, then I'm not going to do this again. I'm not coming back to the regional tournament. So I worked my little butt off. I took the feedback that coach who cut me gave me.
Was the coach right?
The next year, not only did I make the state team, I made the regional team and was a starter.
Excellent. I guess so.
And it was good
for you for accepting that, because you think, man, I know this game, but coach said, so yeah.
Well, I wasn't even about my ego. I don't think my ego was hurt so much. It was that I started to realize that I could play with these other players that were so good.
Yeah.
And that technically I wasn't the strongest player next to these other young women or these girls. I was with them.
Sure.
And so I had to really work on my left foot, my off foot, you know, I had to really work on my precision. I had to work on just simple things. I was fast. I was athletic. I had that going for me. But the biggest feedback that I ever received throughout the span of my career was that I was extremely coachable. And what that meant for me, on my website even, I've put this, I'm like a student of the body. It's like, tell me what I can do and let me embody it and let me feel it in my body and so that I can change it. And I think that's what I did in the last year, was take that feedback. I worked hard at the things where I was weak, an opportunity to grow. And then I came back and I was, you know, not just a little bit better, I was incredibly better from that failure. And so, yeah, part of whenever I speak to youth, it's like, don't be afraid to fail, because those are the moments that are defining. And right. Failure is part of the success, because it's like, you know, I ended up dancing samba a little bit when I moved to Los Angeles. It's beautiful Brazilian dance, and it's a three step, but you actually, like, it's kind of like salsa. You actually like step backwards to move forwards. And I think about that a lot, how you have to take step back in order to, your momentum first has to go back in order to propel you forward. So I want to just say, like, those moments are for you to gather your power again, so that you can better understand where you're going. So yeah, that was a defining moment for me, and it changed my life. And the next year, I remember seeing coach, gosh, it's like a Japanese last name, Matsushido. Shido, yeah. And he was like, boy, I made a mistake. I said, no, you didn't. You didn't. I said, you're the reason I'm here.
That is, I love that story. That, I mean, testament to you, and I love the fact that you own that, and it wasn't just smooth sailing all the way through for you. That, because we all face some adversities at some point, and do you really want it or do you not? And you know, kudos to you for accomplishing that and overcoming that, and then for being able to share it, because that's awesome. I love that story.
Yeah, thank you. Well, and you know, the there's a lot of failure that you can't control, like my knee failing me. Yeah. Right, like in my sophomore year, right after I had made the U23 national team and was supposed to be traveling, I think to Costa Rica, I blew out my knee, ACL, MCL, meniscus. And that was a failure that you just don't have control of, but it was devastating. It was devastating for my trajectory. But in so many ways, if I look back at my life, I wouldn't have realized some of the other dreams that I achieved without that adversity. So and you know, sometimes it feels like when it rains it pours. So I recovered a year and a half later. I got the call from that coach, Abner Rogers. He called and he said, hey, I know it's been a year and a half. I'm headed somewhere else internationally with the U23 roster. Haven't been as pleased with our defense. You are such a strong center back. I want you to come play with me again. He gave me another chance. 2 days later, I had a match in a summer league, and I blew out my knee again. I didn't blow it out, but I tore my meniscus again and had to have surgery, so I couldn't go. So that was like this almost, you know, like almost had actually got to wear a jersey. But the opportunity kind of came again in a different way. In 2008, I ended up, same coach, Abner Rogers, he was taking a team, a B squad, it was an Olympic year, to Mexico for an international before the Olympics. And I got to go with him and wear red, white, and blue in Mexico City. I was not as prepared and fit for that, that elevation. But
That's a different deal, isn't it? Yeah.
It is a different deal. Yeah, it is a different deal. But it was an incredible experience to play, even momentarily, for Team USA.
Wow. Well, congratulations. I mean, that's an achievement that
thank you.
Everybody should be proud of. That's fabulous.
Yeah.
So post soccer.
Yeah.
What are you doing? What are you doing these days? I joked a little bit about your media stuff, and I'm not to downplay it, just because I really did kind of feel like, man, I'm interviewing somebody that does this for money.
Well, I ended up working in radio in the Bay Area for a while. Right when I finished school, the league at the time, I think it was the BLUSA, folded. So playing domestically, professionally wasn't an option for me.
Yeah, that was kind of a turmoil time for women's higher level soccer here,
in the
United.
I mean, I'm so grateful for what's happening right now on the,
on
the
global stage
for women's sports and women's soccer in particular, and the NWSL, and just finally investors, business folks really investing and seeing the value of women's sports, and especially women's soccer. And, you know, gotta give credit to the Rapinos out there, the Megan Rapinos, and you know, Madison Hammond. I would be remiss not to mention the first Native woman to play in the NWSL or professionally. Now I
track her down too.
Oh yeah, I can reach out to her too and just give her a little ping.
Awesome.
I, after just 4 years out of college and saying like, oh my God, I miss that passion. I miss the passion of the job that is playing the sport that I love so much. And I, you know, learned a lot of business in those 4 years, but I kind of just got tired of working for the man. Worked for Clear Channel Radio, and ended up playing in a rec league, then a semi-professional league in San Francisco with a teammate of mine who I played with in that regional team I was telling you about, like back at the ODP. We'd known each other since we were 13, 14, playing at that level as competitors, as like opponents. But then on the regional team, we were on the same team. I ran into her, literally was on a run. She was on a run, running underneath the Golden Gate Bridge. And we started playing together again. And we are still to this day best friends. And she invited me into these, you know, rec league, and then a co-ed rec league, then semi-pro league. And at that semi-pro league, I got to play with the likes of Brandi Chastain and Cece Duamore, who was like the first Marta from Brazil. And these, you know, women, and at the time, I think they were 40 and still just bawling, right? Like, but then even them, Brandi and Cece in different moments would come to me and be like, you're super strong. And then Natalie, my bestie, she ended up going to play in Sweden. Her team ended up needing a center back. So she recruited me, and I ended up going to play professionally in Sweden. Following that, I wanted to get out of the Bay Area. I had family in LA. I moved to LA, and I went there with an open mind, open heart. Like, what am I going to do? Let me pick up this childhood modeling thing that I used to do. That ended up putting me in this casting hustle that is LA. I ended up booking like soccer modeling jobs. And one of them ended up, a friend of mine who was interested in broadcasting said, hey, here's this soccer broadcasting opportunity, go out for it. I went out there, I wore a messy jersey. I ended up booking this show called Fox Football Phone-In on Fox Soccer. And, you know, if I'm being blunt, they were looking for a hot soccer chick. But I got to show them that I actually knew what I was talking about, and had to battle a bunch of sexism within the industry, which became, you know, pretty exhausting. But I eventually found my way to validation and respect, and ended up working as an analyst for Pac-12. But while I was on this journey, I also got incredible opportunities to cover the U.S. women's national team, to cover the men's national team in their World Cup journey. So I got to travel all over with a microphone on the pitch. So I, in many ways, I got to live this dream of playing for the national team, but I was just in a different role. I was on the field, but I was with the microphone, and I got to talk to these players. And at the time, many of them were my peers that I had known from growing up and playing. And that was a really incredible opportunity, and it was so fun and fulfilling, but it was also very exhausting. And at a certain point, I decided that it was time for me to invest in my education again, and was said, well, what do I care about? I care about soccer. I care about my community and my people. I'm getting more and more opportunities with the microphone. And oftentimes in these opportunities, I'm people's only Native American that they've ever met, which is a shame. But I wanted to be mindful of how I was speaking. And I know that I can only speak for myself, but oftentimes people would take what I would say as representative of not just Lummi people, but Native people more broadly.
All Native people, yeah.
Yeah. And so I went back and I was like, I have this microphone. I have this opportunity. I have the power to do something. I better learn something about our communities and understand our trajectory and undo even my own internalized racism, because it is extremely white, and I'm in the upper left, and the Seattle presents itself as progressive. There are so many issues with covert racism, right? And even in Bellingham, just the different things you experience that you don't really realize you're experiencing until you step outside. Sure. So I went back, I got my master's degree in American Indian Studies. My thesis is called North American Indigenous Soccer, Visibility, Healing, and Shilangin, which means way of life, in global football. And wow. I got to essentially uncover parts of myself and better understand the realities, the contemporary success and realities and power of Native people and tribal nations. But I also, it was also a really hard couple years reading the true histories and the atrocities of our communities. But it really helped me better understand myself and my family, and it really helped me be a better storyteller when I did have those opportunities. So here I am now. I work in communications. We support at Pyramid Communications. We have a few practice areas where we focus on climate and environment, health, education, philanthropy, and Indian country. So I lead the Indian country practice with 5 to 7. We have some consultants sometimes, 5 to 7 other Native strategists. At our Indian country practice and teams and the full team at Pyramid Communications, we support tribes, tribal nations, and Native-led organizations to strategically think through their priorities and accomplish their communications goals. So that could be anything from advancing policy, making sure, say there's some, just an example, Standing Rock, we supported the government at Standing Rock, the tribal council, in making sure that, say, Obama had the information he needed to, put a hold, or I can't even remember what the terminology was back then. But we would, we build coalitions for tribal nations. If there's an issue around water rights, we support tribes with water rights. Those are some bigger ideas. We definitely do work in native vote, get out the native vote. We work for my own people, which was kind of how I ended up in this opportunity. Is my uncle knew the founder of Pyramid, has worked with Pyramid for 30 years. And one of my goals in coming back home, now that Seattle isn't technically home, but it's the same sea, was to be able to serve my community, because we have, as you know, like we have an obligation to our community and to the land and to the people.
Yes.
So it's kind of come full circle, but I certainly would not be here if it weren't for the education of global football and you know, academics, quite frankly, and how those go hand in hand.
Right. That it just shows how what you can accomplish, even, you know, coming from a little bit smaller kind of community situations, right? People that have success in life come from all different places. And I think that is one of the biggest messages that I want the youth of today to be able to take away, is that whether it's in sports, whether it's in business, whether it's in music, whatever, you can do this.
Yeah.
To believe in yourself, right? And that's
where
it really all starts.
Yeah, and you'll be surprised when you are passionate, you work hard, you stay committed, you accept your failures and turn them into pathways for success, you'd be surprised who is in your corner, right? You'd be surprised who's been watching, or maybe you won't be, but there will be people along the way, and it is okay to ask for help. It is okay to ask for help. I certainly did not do this alone. Nothing. None of my success has been because of me. It has been because of my family, my community, the teachings, the ancestors, right? If I'm in a moment where I feel alone, I call on my ancestors. That would be what I share with the youth. You're never alone.
Powerful words, for sure. Yeah.
Hey there, sports history fan. This is Arnie Chapman, aka the Football History Dude, and I hope that you enjoyed this recent episode presented by the Sports History Network and were able to learn some good old-fashioned sports history knowledge nuggets. I started the Sports History Network back in 2020 with the mission to help podcasters find a community of like-minded sports history nerds, as well as helping aspiring podcasters to start their own shows. We have a little bit over 30 shows on the network right now covering all sorts of sports history, but as far as I'm concerned, we're just at the toothpick in the ocean moment, you know, that can't even figure it out because there's so much more coming. We wanted to create the ultimate headquarters for sports yesteryear, starting with Podcast Network and our website, but we're going to continue to move into other mediums as well. And here's the cool part, because we want you to be part of our team. So if you're interested in starting your own podcast, or maybe being a guest on one of our shows, or who knows, maybe even writing an article for us over on the website. Seriously, all you got to do is reach out to us on the contact page over at sportshistorynetwork.com. You can be as technologically savvy as a Neanderthal tapping on a stone trying to figure out this whole hieroglyphics thing back in the day. Again, it doesn't matter, because even if you don't understand the whole podcast space, we have a production team that can pretty much help you out with doing everything. All you got to do, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com, head to the contact page, fill it out. That message goes right to me, and I'll reach out to you as soon as I can. But for now, dude, I'm through if you're through.